during our gathering hymns, we invite you to come forward and place a stone in one of the bowls of water located on either aisle. Our service each Sunday includes all of the earth elements, earth, water, air, and fire. The element of water is essential to all life, and it may symbolize the healing tears of love, compassionate understanding, purification, repose, or change, the passage of time, and the transcendence of earthly conditions. While the element of earth, represented by the stones, is a container and maintainer of life. As matter, the stones ground and stabilize us, and these stones can symbolize humility, forgiveness, practicality, wisdom, and eternity. Would you now rise for our gathering hymns, "Do You Hear?" and "Soon the Day Will Arrive." The words are on the front of the sanctuary. We are grateful for these gifts freely given to help us do our good work in the world. Thank you very much. The death of poet Mary Oliver this past week has given a little bit different angle to my entry into today's sermon and the readings chosen to accompany it. There are among the critics of Oliver's poetry those who consider her writing too simple, perhaps even fluffy and unimportant. I'm not one of them. Oliver did write short, accessible poems about the world around her, but many of her admirers recognized in these beautifully described, often fleeting moments, a deep reverence for life and a source of spiritual sustenance and renewal. To name just three of her subjects, Mary Oliver wrote about wild geese, about dogs, and about trees. The titles of three tree poems are When I Am Among Trees, A Dream About Trees, and About Angels and Trees. I knew a poet, the late Pearl Sawyer, a Unitarian Universalist in Maine, who also wrote poetry about everyday experience. One time at an open mic night, another poet whose poetry was inclined to rage against systems of power made a disparaging remark about the simplicity of Pearl's topics and themes. Apparently, to talk about trees is an effective way to ruffle feathers of all kinds of birds. This Martin Luther King Jr. weekend is a good time to ask the question, what kind of times are we living in? How often in your lifetimes have you asked this question as hardship, chaos, and ill will seem to take over our lives like black smog, causing us to choke and cough as we gasp for breath? What kind of poetry do you turn to? What kind of leaders do you seek to find a way out of the morass? In a Brain Pickings blog that puts the two poems you've heard this morning into dialogue with each other, Maria Popova writes, "To ask ourselves what kind of time we live in is to consider the sources of our sorrow and unease, to confront the brokenness, but also to discover the cracks through which the light gets in. It is the poet's task, poet in the expansive James Baldwinian sense of wakeful artist in any medium, to do the asking so that we may contemplate an answer and find a little more ease, perhaps even the promise of spaciousness and light in the act of contemplation." Writing from exile in Denmark at the end of the 1930s, as terror was engulfing Europe, Bertolt Brecht's poem, "To Those Who Follow in Our Wake," posed the question about what kind of times are we living in. He did so chillingly. What times are these in which a conversation about trees is almost a crime, for in doing so, we maintain our silence about so much wrongdoing. Brecht was saying that to talk about normal things, about everyday life, was an act of resistance. I knew two widows of resistors to Nazism who told me the same in the everyday language of survivors. You did what you had to do to stay alive. And a half century later, the feminist poet Adrienne Rich picked up Brecht's question in her piercing 1991 poem titled, What Kind of Times Are These?, and reframed it into a new landscape of possibility that contained within itself the answer. We must talk about that which continues to live in the midst of the oppression and marginalization. I would suggest that the question and answer are addressed time and time again throughout human history in words and images that are life-affirming and hopeful, and that urge us to act and to lead. Lifting our voices, which is a relatively new, maybe not so new anymore, volume of readings in the living tradition, contains an adaptation of the 1957 words of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. that speaks about the type of leaders needed for the kind of times in which Adrienne Rich speaks in her poem. The speech in which King lifted up the following prayer was actually a paraphrase of words penned in 1872 by Josiah Gilbert Holland, a 19th century novelist and poet who wrote a biography of Abraham Lincoln. MLK Jr. prayed to God. A time like this demands great leaders, leaders whom the lust of office does not kill, leaders whom the spoils of life cannot buy, leaders who possess opinions and a will, leaders who have honor, leaders who will not lie, leaders who can stand before a demagogue and damn treacherous flatteries without winking. Tall leaders, sun-crowned, who live above the fog in public duty and public thinking. I am looking around these days and wondering who and where are these great leaders. Some of them have left public office and will continue to be great leaders, but in very different ways. Others have served this country and have left an even greater mark on the world through their service to humankind. Some of these great leaders are still in the chambers of our government at the local, state, and national levels. They will hold fast to their principles and work hard for the greater good, for economic equality, for civil rights, for environmental justice. Other leaders work on these issues through their professional pursuits in the halls of academia, in research laboratories, in educating children and youth, the next generations who will live amidst the consequences of the decisions that are made by the adults in their lives. There are leaders who write poetry and leaders who create visual art, leaders who are journalists and critics calling our attention to what is happening and the connections between action and impact. Still more leaders focus their efforts on taking care of the hungry and the homeless, the sick and the dying. The truth is, in times like these, every single one of us is called to be a great leader, to speak of the trees in the forests of injustice so that people will listen. All of us must be fully alive leaders who cannot be bought, who do not lie, who do not wink. Each of us possesses the character traits of a great leader, someone with opinions and determination, honorable and above the fog. It won't be easy. I would not be true to King's description of great leaders if I pretended that this mantle is a light one to wear. Bertolt Brecht recognized that acts of resistance risked during the dark times in which he lived in Nazi Germany and as an exile in Denmark were complex and complicated. The contradictions of surviving while resisting dark forces in the world weigh heavily on our hearts. What times are these, he says, in which a conversation about trees is almost a crime, for in doing so, we maintain our silence about so much wrongdoing. The paradox then is, do we talk about the trees or not? Do we talk about what is beautiful and peaceful or only about the terrible news? Or taking a different approach to this paradox of talking about trees, do we focus our efforts on the details of the trees, or do we work on dismantling the forests, the systems of injustice, marginality, and oppression? I believe the answer is that we have to pay attention to all of it. We must keep awake not only to the ugliness, but also to the beauty. We cannot ignore the injustice, neither the near at hand nor the holes in the wider net of mutuality. During the 2016 Service of the Living Tradition, an annual General Assembly tradition for Unitarian Universalists, the Reverend Bill Sinkford delivered a sermon during which he reflected on our involvement in the civil rights movement over the last 50 plus years. These 5 decades of justice work have been an answer to the call of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who spoke to the General Assembly as the Ware Lecturer in 1966, urging the delegates and participants not to sleep through the revolution, but to stay woke as we are being reminded again to do and to be. Our destinies are tied up with the destinies of every part of our human family. King reminded his audience that we must live together as siblings or we will all perish together as fools. This is a fact of life. No individual can live alone. No nation can live alone. King charged the Church Universal to remain awake in the revolution, to stay connected, to make its voice heard on matters of racial equality and the immorality of segregation. Even today, the detrimental legacy of Jim Crow laws affects the economic, social, and physical well-being of people of color. Reverend Sinkford told the UUA General Assembly that love calls us on to both continue and deepen our work for racial justice, for economic equality, for environmental sustainability, and so much more. Love calls us to stay woke. Love calls on us not to sleep through the revolution. Love demands that we respond to chaos by strengthening our communities. Love calls us to declare that Black lives matter. And it must be a clarion call that Black lives matter, because when we repair the injustice done to the least of our society, we heal all lives. Sinkford was reminding us of what King told the 1966 General Assembly, that in order to stay woke through the revolution, the church must move out into the arena of social action. It is not enough for the church to work in the ideological realm and to clear up misguided ideas, to remain awake through this, and I might add parenthetically, any social revolution. The church must engage in strong social action programs to get rid of the last vestiges of segregation and discrimination. King cautioned his audience that while progress in racial justice had certainly been accomplished, exaggeration of that progress was not helpful. And we have seen that this is true indeed with the events of the last few years. 50 years ago, King described the plant of freedom as merely in bud and not yet in flower. I think it is clear that we are still looking at the bud stage. And what we must do our utmost to prevent is a blight, the likes of which would destroy any possibility of flowering. For that reason, we must, as King said in his April 16, 1963 letter from Birmingham Jail, be extremists for the extension of justice. Here is an adaptation which appears in Lifting Our Voices. The question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists will we be? Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice? Only you can answer these questions for yourselves. Each of us will determine how we resist the injustice around us. We know only for ourselves the form of protest that resonates best with our personalities and or our lives and the resources that we have. I'm not a person who yells during protests. I am willing to be there in body and spirit. I am far more moved to sing protest songs than to shout out slogans. I believe that Unitarian Universalists as a faith community decided long ago to be extremists for love and to act extremely to extend justice at every opportunity. To be extremists for the extension of justice, we do need to stretch a little further and even further still. We will have to find our limits and do our best to move past those limits. But what that means for us as individuals depends upon our own unique circumstances. There is a discernible line that can be drawn connecting MLK Jr. to Gandhi and even to our Unitarian forebear, the Transcendentalist Henry David Thoreau. For Thoreau, not paying his taxes and going to jail in an act of civil disobedience was being an extremist for extending justice. Thoreau recognized the role of taxes in the system of oppression that kept African Americans enslaved, as well as funding wars. Simply stating that the ideology of war or slavery was wrong in an attempt to clear up misguided ideas, as many of his peers and compatriots were doing, would not have been enough. Thoreau's discourse on civil disobedience would never have taken on the life that it did if it hadn't been based in real, lived experience. Thoreau took action. He refused to pay his taxes. And then, having failed to do what was required of him, he was jailed for breaking the law. I have sometimes wondered what would have happened if the person who did hadn't come and bailed him out, but instead joined Henry David as a tax resister. I personally choose to pay my taxes and take other steps to make my voice heard in Washington, including signing petitions and writing letters to the editor, but I have known several people during my adult life who are committed tax resisters. One way that they do this is to exist below the poverty line, earning just enough to live on but not enough to owe taxes. Similar to the religious who take a vow of poverty, these tax resistors are materially poor, but ever so rich in spirit. Love of community and country, but fear of the ways of governments are at the heart of civil disobedience. Gandhi understood the power of this kind of nonviolent protest to communicate the need for change. He also lived life as an extremist for the extension of justice. The Great Salt March in 1930 was an act of tax resistance, too. And it was extreme. Imagine walking 240 miles over 24 days. According to reports, more than 80,000 Indians were jailed for their involvement in this and related acts of nonviolent civil disobedience against the British colonial power. 80,000 people. What would happen if we did that here? Although the large-scale protests of this kind did not happen in response to Hitler's rise to power in Germany, there were many different forms of resistance during the 1930s and 40s. Poet Bertolt Brecht's despair notwithstanding, to stay alive was an act of resistance. To survive as a Jew, a socialist, a Roma, or a sexual minority was to defy the ideology of Nazism. For some of us in the 21st century America, staying alive will also be the only act of resistance we can shoulder. If you are gay, lesbian, or bisexual, or if you are transgender, living as your authentic self may be the most courageous form of protest possible. If you are a person of color, staying safe and staying alive, let alone being seen as successful, constitute acts of civil disobedience in some sense already. Because by virtue of the color of one's skin, people of color defy the hate of white supremacy that still stains the history of our civil society. If you are an immigrant or the child of immigrants, your citizenship is denied by those who would isolate the United States from the rest of humanity. Your presence in our communities, along with Muslim and Jewish Americans, make our lives so much richer and more interesting. Celebrating the cultures and customs of your native country and sharing the wisdom from your faith goes against our history of conquest, colonialization, and assimilation. In each of these examples, a healthy self-esteem provides a solid core for grounding in the midst of fierce unrest, resistance, and nonviolent protest. If grounded in self-love, our outward actions cannot help but come from love. Based in the methods and examples of Thoreau and Gandhi, Martin Luther King took nonviolent civil disobedience even further. King made much of the role of love in his vision of nonviolent revolution. Nonviolence uses moral means to secure moral ends, and a just society is achieved through just methods. King believed with all his heart that if every human being fully embodied the love ethic, the golden rule about treating others as we wish to be treated and loving our neighbors as ourselves, it would lead to social revolution. For King, what made the 20th century civil rights movement different was that in addition to hope that true freedom would be achieved, there was also love. The kind of love we mean when we say that we side with love. King urged the world to realize that power without love is reckless and abusive, and that love without power is sentimental and anemic. In another adaptation of King's words, since power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice, and justice at its best is power correcting everything that stands against love, how can we not choose to stay woke? How can we not choose to be extremists for the extension of justice? It has been said that America hasn't experienced as much political and social crisis as it is now since 50 years ago. It is time we reclaim the legacy of Thoreau, Gandhi, and especially Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights warriors whose resistance to oppression have been bending the arc of justice, the universe towards justice. Anytime we gather peacefully as a community to express our sorrow, our anger, our support, or our disagreement about an issue of social, economic, or political importance, we are following in Thoreau, Gandhi, and King's footsteps. I urge you to look for ways that you can participate in resistance to inequality and injustice. Be extremists for extending justice to all people. My prayer is that we choose not to sleep through the revolution. May ours be a fierce unrest, and may we nourish ourselves during times like these with beauty as created by poets, artists, and musicians. Would you now please rise in body or spirit to sing hymn number 159, "This Is My Song." The words will be on the wall. Please join me now in a time of prayer and meditation. For those of you who don't know, Paul Galvin is recovering from a fall at home. He's doing well. All reports are that his sense of humor is completely intact. Sometimes our prayers are imbued with humor. Other times they are deeply wrenching. As a poet has said, joy and woe are woven fine. They are both woven into the lives of this community and the lives of people around the world. We delight in new life, in milestones made, in reconnecting with people who we haven't been in touch with for a long time. We also know that sometimes the pain that we carry is so deep that we must share it with others in order to get through. And we are grateful for this community that offers so much love, and compassion, so much support and understanding. And yet, there are both joys and sorrows that we hold closely in our hearts, not ready or not able to share with those around us. And we recognize that even so, we need to hold each other with love, hold each other with compassion and understanding, so that we can all move out into the world and act from a place of love that connects all of humanity to each other. Please join me now in a time of silence. Spirit of life, grateful for this community of seeking and service, we say, Amen, Namaste, and blessed be. Please rise in body or spirit for hymn number 155, Circle Round for Freedom. We'll sing it through twice, and then I have some closing words. We extinguish our chalice, for the worship has ended. Our service begins.